All right, so we're looking tonight at this lesson 7, dealing with various functions of people that serve the church in some way, whether we're saying the local or the universal, it depends somewhat on the office. But we started out by talking about the pastors, elders, overseers that were to be appointed in each church that had the responsibility to shepherd the church, to watch over, to protect and so forth, being kind of analogous to what a shepherd would do with sheep. And we talked a little bit about their responsibilities, especially teaching responsibility, admonishing, trying to take care of and watch out for the best interests spiritually of God's people. They give an account for them. We talked about the limitations on the oversight, that there's no indication that elders ever were responsible for anything more than the congregation they were appointed to shepherd. And we talked some about the choice of elders and that there are qualifications. Those qualifications are not just like an arbitrary list God pulled out of a hat, but are the things that you need to be able to do the kind of work that elders would do. We also talked about the idea that all of us need to be doing some of the kinds of things elders do. That the same word in verb form that's used for overseers is used for what we're supposed to do, watching out for each other in Hebrews 12. We're supposed to be teaching each other. We're supposed to be exhorting and encouraging and helping, so that the elders have a special responsibility in this, but it's a responsibility all of us have to the extent we're able in trying to help build up and strengthen and encourage each other. So it's not like the elders have the exclusive rights to this function and nobody else should do any of that. Terry.
Well, that's really interesting to me in looking at that, because you know what, those qualifications and the people doing these things are the ones who eventually meet these qualifications of an elder.
Yes, exactly. So you don't appoint someone and suddenly they weren't doing any of this and now they start doing it all. They are growing as Christians in taking care of each other and caring about each other, building each other up and so forth. So yeah, I think that's exactly right. Good thought. Any other thoughts or comments, questions about elders? I think we pretty much finished that Sunday. I don't want to talk a little bit about deacons. We know very little about deacons in the New Testament. You've got the passage in 1 Timothy chapter 3. Maybe that's a good place to start. It's the longest passage dealing with deacons. In verse, at least that uses the name deacon. In 1 Timothy 3:8, deacons likewise must be men of dignity, not double-tongued or addicted to much wine or fond of sordid gain, but holding to the mystery of the faith with a clear conscience. These men must also first be tested, then let them serve as deacons if they are beyond reproach. Women must likewise be dignified, not malicious gossips, but temperate, faithful in all things. Deacons must be husbands of only one wife and good managers of their children and their own households. For those who served well as deacons obtained for themselves a high standing and great confidence in the faith that's in Christ Jesus. Well, those qualities suggest that the deacon ought to be a solid, reliable man, a man who's living faithfully before God, a man who's been tested and proven, a man who's faithful doctrinally, a man who's a good husband and father, and so forth. But it doesn't tell you anything about the specific role of a deacon. In fact, there's no passage that just says, like, deacons are to be doing these things. But we know the word deacon refers to a servant. In fact, the word is used a lot of times in verb form especially, and also in noun form, for people who served. That were not congregationally appointed deacons, but they served. And this is an even more obvious illustration of the fact that deacons do not monopolize on the serving function of a church. There shouldn't just be a few deacons that serve and everybody else doesn't serve, but they are appointed perhaps for specific works of service. I think it's helpful to go to Acts chapter 6. Acts chapter 6 uses the verb form of deacon. I can't perhaps conclusively prove that we ought to call these men deacons, but it looks to me like that's exactly what we're dealing with here. When you had that dispute about the food service for the widows, some of the widows, some people thought their widows were being neglected in this food service. The Grecian widows were being neglected. It was the native Hebrews that were being taken care of, they thought. So the 12 got the disciples together and said, you need to select seven good men. Seven men of good reputation, verse 3, full of the spirit and of wisdom, whom we may put in charge of this task. But we will devote ourselves to prayer and to the ministry of the word. They weren't going to get distracted by this job because they already had an important function, the 12 did, the prayer and preaching. And so they said, select seven good spiritual men, wise men, men who have a good reputation to put in charge of this. And they did. You find the men they chose in verse 5. And so they began to oversee and serve in the role of seeing to it that the food service was distributed equitably among the widows. I would suggest if those aren't to be considered official deacons, at least I don't know what the difference would be between deacons appointed by a church and these men. Jason?
At the very least, they're a precursor. I think that's safe
to say. Right. Yeah, they're the pattern of what we see in deacons. So I wouldn't strenuously try to argue with somebody who insisted these weren't actual deacons, but the verb form of deacon is used for their service here, and the serving tables, and I think this is the kind of thing we ought to envision, that deacons are good men in a congregation the church appoints to do specific things. They have special roles that they are at least in charge of. I don't know, but what these seven men may not have used some other people to help in some areas doesn't mean they have to do it all themselves. They may delegate some, but they were responsible for this. The only other passage that really uses the word deacon is in Philippians chapter 1, uses it in a local church deacon sense. Philippians chapter 1 and verse 1, where Paul writes to all the saints in Christ Jesus who are in Philippi, including the overseers and deacons, which gives you the idea that they are kind of specific functions in that church, the overseers, the elders, the pastors, and the deacons. You might think about the deacons we have here. I don't know how many of us really think about what their roles are. But if we do, it gives us a clue as to who we might turn to with specific needs and situations. You know, if we had a situation regarding the collection and the money for the church, which deacon would be responsible for that? You know? Terry? Uh-huh. Yeah. And what if there was a building, a maintenance issue? Who would you go to for that? I heard a couple people say it, Jared. And what if there was an issue related to technology, the internet, the website, and things like that? Who would we turn to? Austin. What about the resource room and the teaching of the kids' classes? That would be Chad. And let's see, what about benevolence? Steve, right. So those aren't the only roles each one of them has necessarily, but they have specific works they do, specific things they're kind of taking care of. And I think that's the appropriate way to look at that. You know, a deacon's not some honorary position. We're not trying to lift up any men. They've just got specific areas of service. Jason. Yeah, junior elders. Right. Yes. Yeah. The fact that they're mentioned elders and deacons in Philippians 1, or that you've got the qualifications beside each other, doesn't mean this is a step toward that necessarily. Somebody may serve as a deacon for a while and may serve as an elder for a while, or vice versa. That would be possible. But it's certainly not like this is, vice elder or something like that. The deacons are servants that are in a congregation appointed to specific roles. Good thought. And also, Jason, you said 2 points.
The other point more, question. In the Acts passage, it seems like this specific need that they're appointing men for was more of a short-term thing. Now, may that show or imply that it's not always the case that it has to be a full-time position where you just have a need for a short period of time? appoint them, and then once the need's done, you know, more positions.
Yeah, maybe so. Yeah, I hadn't really thought about that. I don't know how long-term that need was for those widows. Maybe you would reassign roles if you had those as well. But I think the idea that, well, you know, we appointed a man as a deacon, there's no real work for him to do, but he's still a deacon. It's like, well, he's not really a servant if he's not serving in some special way. And so I think that, yeah, if you didn't have a service, you've just got a title. You don't really have the role. So that might be the case that somebody would step down at that point. Terry. Right.
And it shows that because later on we find one of these seven guys in a couple other places here in Acts, he was overdoing some other things.
Right, yeah. Of course, that was after the persecution and spread them all out. That may have really become obsolete, his role at that point, when there may not be any more widows in Jerusalem. I don't know. But yes, you're right. And he was a servant of the word, a preacher of the gospel, and continued in that role. So it's not like there's a fixed role that you have. You only will do this for the rest of your life. You know, roles can change as needs change or as your situation changes or whatever. Good thoughts. Justin.
Kind of two questions. One is, have we seen, I don't know that we see it in the New Testament, but I mean, in, I guess group experience, have we seen deacons appointed and not in eldership?
Good question.
And then the second would be, I guess I've never, you know, we know it's there in 1 Timothy 3, but never heard of how a man is kind of tried or he is tested before he is, you know, put into the spot.
I'm assuming the testing there means you just need to know him well enough and have seen him in various situations long enough that he's kind of been a proven man, as opposed to somebody new in the group or somebody new in the faith. Or whatever, that you really haven't seen them in any kind of situation that would be harder to see if they're really persevering and solid people. That's what I think that means. As far as your first question, maybe Acts 6 is an example of appointing deacons without there being elders. Maybe there were elders already in that church. Maybe the apostles were kind of serving in that way. I know of a church who appointed deacons without elders. I don't think there'd be any problem with that. I don't know of any other church who's done that. But I think it'd be fine to have specially appointed servants even when there weren't people qualified to be elders. Jason.
And practically speaking, a lot of churches probably do without calling
them. Right, yeah. Yeah, there are people who serve, and we may not use the word deacon, but the congregation has chosen them because they're qualified to do certain things. So, yeah, that may be true. Chris. Okay, yeah, that's a good question. I thought somebody would ask it. I didn't know who it would be, but I figured it'd be Jason. So, yeah. So, you know, you've got two things in the Bible that would be pointed to as evidence for females serving as deacons. One of them is that passage in Romans 16, where he says, "I commend to you our sister Phoebe, who's a servant of the church which is at Sancrea." It's the word for deacon. Now, the word is used for servants who were not deacons in the official way. So it's difficult to prove conclusively, but if we believe there are female deacons, this surely is good evidence for that. You know, if we don't, we're going to say this is just a servant of the church, but not in an officially appointed capacity. The other passage that's key in that is in 1 Timothy 3:11. I read it, but I didn't draw attention to it, where it says, "Women must likewise be dignified, not malicious gossips, but temperate, faithful in all things." My margin says that is either deacons' wives or deaconesses. The word is wives or women. There's not a difference in the word in the original. So is he saying these are female deacons and these are their qualifications? Or is he saying these are the qualifications for the wife of a deacon? Now, if I wanted to say they were female deacons, I would camp out in verse 11 on the word likewise. Because look at verse 7. "Deacons likewise Women likewise, in verse 11, that would seem to indicate a separate group by his use of that word likewise. If I wanted to say that there were, could not be female deacons, I would camp out on the idea that in 12 and 13, he goes back to the male deacons. So you've got male deacons from 8 to 10 and male deacons from 12 to 13. And so it would seem more natural that we're still talking about qualifications for the male deacons and just talking about what their wives have to be. After all, he continues talking about they must be husbands of only one wife, good managers of their children, their own households. I don't have a horse in the race. I don't care. I think you can make a good argument on both sides. I would not have an objection to the appointing of female deacons. I certainly don't think that should ever be done to the detriment of the unity of the group, and that would probably, you know, kick it out for most churches. But I think it's a reasonable thought. It's not conclusive. Jason. Right.
There's usually a woman you trust saying, okay, this is who we go to for this, this is who we go to for this. So usually there are those women in the congregation. We just are too self-conscious, not so we just don't want to call them that.
Right, sure. Yeah, and we haven't specifically appointed them in any kind of an official sort of a way. But you're right. There are women who serve special roles that are essentially doing the work that a woman servant does, and we know who they are here, and we turn to them, and so yeah, you're right about that. So I don't really know. I don't have a strong feeling one way or the other. I think you can argue it either way. Jonah. Sure, if you had female deacons, clearly that would be a reasonable role. You would only appoint a woman as a deacon to do works that were appropriate for a woman to do. And that is a specific work that God's told women to do. So in that sense, yes, it would have to be things like that or other things that would be within their role where they're not taking authority over men. Justin? Okay. Other questions or comments? Jason? Right. I don't have a strong answer on that one. We may be on safest ground just to say, since it always says deacons, let's be sure and do that. But that's probably a debatable case on both deacons and elders. So I don't have a strong view on that. Yeah, Juliana. Well, you might conceivably have only one person qualified. You might have a small church that only had one man who was really in that role. But yeah, I mean, most of the time there's more work to do than just what you need for one person. I agree with that. I don't know that I've ever heard in practice of a church crossing that situation, but there may be one who has, and I don't know what they've done in that situation. You know, it's worth talking about. I appreciate the openness of the group here in discussing various things. I do think we always strive to try to understand the best we can what the Bible's saying. You know, that's our standard. And trying not in difficult questions where we have little evidence to go on, certainly trying to make sure that what we do, we can all do in good conscience. Terry. Yes. Good point. Yeah, they need the seven, you know. So yeah, that's true. And so you might very well have multiple deacons assigned to the same thing because you need more than one doing that job. Yeah, that's a good point.
And I think the thing that's interesting about Texas, it doesn't say we need men who are proficient at, it wasn't talking about like their technical skill. It said you need five men who have good reputations and they're spiritual men and that. Kind of the assumption was that the character is what's going to guide them to be able to do the work and not like well, he's a great electrician kind of thing.
Right, yeah. Good point. He does say full of wisdom, but that would also be really a spiritual quality. And yeah, I mean, certainly in elders and deacons both, the spiritual character is the key, not some proficiency in some sort of skill. Yeah. Good thought. All right. Well, let's go to evangelists and talk about them a little bit. Look at 2 Timothy 4. In 2 Timothy 4, 2 Timothy 4, verse 5, Paul tells Timothy, "But you be sober in all things, endure hardship, do the work of an evangelist, fulfill your ministry." His saying, do the work of an evangelist, seems to me to indicate there is a specific role of evangelist as one who preaches the gospel. Now, I think we're dealing with the same thing with evangelists that we did with elders and deacons. It's not an exclusive role. You see people in the book of Acts chapter 8, when the Christians were scattered, they all went about everywhere preaching the word. So it's not like an evangelist monopolizes on the work of preaching and teaching, but there are some like Timothy who had especially dedicated themselves to that role. Now, think about a couple of things with regard to that. There's not, as far as I know, any list of qualifications for that. There's not an appointment to that, as far as I know. And an evangelist is not really a servant of a local church per se. An evangelist works for the Lord. An evangelist may be teaching and preaching and helping in a local church, or may be traveling about. I think both are possibilities. But Timothy and Titus are good books to consider some of the roles of evangelists, the things that he exhorts them to do in teaching and preaching and refuting false doctrine and things like that would be roles that evangelists ought to have among God's people. Terry.
Well, in Ephesians, I think it was 4th chapter, remember in the church when they were talking about, they had these positions in the church, and the whole picture of all this together was to edify the church. And he says, you know, there's people need to be doing these things.
Yeah, and actually, you know, those people, he talks about the apostles and prophets, the evangelists and the pastors and teachers, were building up the saints to do the work of serving to build up the body of Christ, or equipping the saints to do the work of serving to build up the body of Christ. So in some ways, what all of these functions are doing is helping Christians grow to work to serve so that everybody, every member, every part is active and functioning. So one of the roles of an evangelist is building up Christians and helping them serve, as well as evangelizing what we'd usually think in terms of teaching non-Christians the gospel. I think both of those are appropriate roles of an evangelist. Thoughts and comments about all that? Jason. Sure. Yeah. The idea that a church, well, the idea that a church has an evangelist may be a little bit erroneous to begin with, but the idea that a church needs to have an evangelist as one of its members is not true. I mean, there's plenty of churches that don't have a man who's really dedicated to being an evangelist, and they do well. I mean, in Brazil, there's almost no churches that have what they would think of as an evangelist. The members work to preach and teach and do what they can, but there's not somebody who's sort of taking on that role. So yeah, there's certainly not, it's not like a church appoints elders, deacons, and evangelists. Evangelists are people who choose to do that role themselves, and they may be working in a church, they may be working among churches, they may be working and evangelizing people who aren't Christians. Jason. Yeah, there is that idea among even some religious groups really do exalt an evangelist and make him kind of the ruler or the leader of the church. And I don't think that is the role. I mean, and if you're preaching the gospel, you have the authority of God to preach his word and to exhort people to follow it. But you are not the authority in the church, like you run things or you're the one trying to make be sure that everybody does what they're supposed to. You exhort, you teach, But it would be the elders who are overseeing the group. And so, yeah, that's a good point. Jason.
And what makes you an evangelist is not the idea that you're getting support.
Good. Yeah, good point. Paul. I think he was doubled as an evangelist as well as an apostle. But he sometimes worked with his hands. He was a leather worker. And sometimes he received support from churches. Sometimes we refuse support from churches because he thought it wasn't appropriate in the situation. So yes, an evangelist doesn't necessarily have to be paid in doing that. There might be some who would need that. I've been impressed recently in reading 3 John and thinking about John's encouragement of Gaius when he said in 3 John 5, beloved, you're acting faithfully in whatever you accomplish for the brethren, and especially when they're strangers. And he says in 6, you will do well to send them on their way in a manner worthy of God, for they went out for the sake of the name, accepting nothing from the Gentiles. Therefore, we ought to support such men so they may be fellow workers with the truth. Here's some guys who just gone out to spread the gospel. They don't have a way to make a living. They're traveling, evidently. And he says, you know, the non-Christians aren't going to support them. You know, this is a responsibility we have. So there may be some that would be very appropriate for us to do that with, but certainly being paid or being supported is not inherent in the role of an evangelist. Good thought. Other comments? Justin.
Is there, I've run into this with some of the brethren in Ghana, where the church might, local church might be wanting to support an evangelist, but the elders are restricting the use of that money so that they do not want it to be used in that way. And there was almost a sense in which the giving was being diverted, you know, for other than the support of the evangelist. And so the brother asked me, and another brother in Christ, if that was a function of an elder, if an elder could essentially deny support, or if the elders could deny support to a man who was working as an evangelist. And he brought up a passage in, I think it's 1 Timothy 5, where it talks about the laborers worthy of his hire and things of that nature. And I just kind of try to direct him back towards the congregation needed to somehow direct their concerns back towards their eldership, in effect, in terms of how what their intention for that money was being used versus how it was being implicated. And so his question was, can an eldership restrict that?
Okay, so you might have several issues in all that. If people were giving to support that person, and the elders didn't give it to him, that would be a problem because that's what it was being given for. On the other hand, if it's just that some of the members thought that that would be a good work for the church to do, the elders might think it wasn't because they didn't have confidence in the person or they thought he was a false teacher. Or maybe the elders just don't like doing that. I mean, in 3 John, Diotrephes didn't want anybody receiving these traveling evangelists. And if they did, he kicked them out of his church, which I said his church purposely, and that seems to have been. And so I think you might need to know more about the context to know whether, what was appropriate. Certainly, I would encourage brethren in a situation like that, they need to talk. The elders and the brethren need to discuss it and understand each other and see where they're coming from. Jason. Yeah, there's a whole lot of things we don't know in the New Testament, but certainly we have the example of giving toward a need, and that seems to be a good pattern for us to follow. I don't know when churches gave money to Paul and things like that, all the procedures that were followed, but But, you know, just the idea of we're giving to build up a bank account would not be a good idea. And we'll talk about that eventually. I think we'll get to that in these lessons. I have lessons on it, so hopefully we'll get there. Jacob.
And you don't necessarily have to go through the church to support an evangelist.
True.
You can just say, okay, I'm giving this money to the local church, you all just need it how you please. I'm giving a little bit, and I'm just going to directly give it to this person.
Certainly, yes. Galatians 6:6 would be a specific passage about that, but yes, that's a good point. Brandon.
Just a question. So anytime you're spreading the gospel or teaching the gospel, I mean, is that considered being, you know, like a Wednesday night?
So I think it'd be the same thing as like somebody can be watching for souls and edifying, but they're not appointed as an elder where they have that specific function. Somebody can be serving a church, but they're not appointed as a deacon where they have a specific role in that. And somebody can be preaching and teaching the gospel, but they may not consider themselves an evangelist where that's kind of their primary focus in their life and in their thinking. All of us in many ways ought to be teaching, evangelizing. As I said in Acts 8, it was just the Christians that were scattered by persecution that went about everywhere preaching the word. So if we think, well, I'm not an evangelist. I don't need to teach anybody. I don't need to preach to anybody. I don't need to evangelize. No, no, no. We all ought to be doing all we can in all of those roles. Jason.
Yeah, we don't do our work by
Friday. Right, sure. Yeah, and we couldn't really because more work needs to be done than can be done through one person. Right. I suspect he's talking about anybody who's teaching. In James 3:1, you've got a passage that's a little disconcerting for us. Let not many of you become teachers, my brethren, knowing that as such we will incur a stricter judgment. You know, we're usually trying to encourage people to teach. You need to teach. We need to teach more people. And here it's throwing cold water on that. Don't let many of you become teachers. You'll receive a stricter judgment. I think he's really stressing the responsibility that comes when you teach. If you teach something that's false and mislead people, it may cause them to lose their soul. Not that we shouldn't teach, but we shouldn't teach without giving it adequate thought. We shouldn't teach prematurely. We need to know what we're talking about before we teach because of the grave responsibility that we have. So I think that would apply really to anybody in any teaching role. I would sometimes suggest we shouldn't teach beyond what we know clearly. And this may be a challenge for all of us sometimes, but I thought about it this way. When I first started more doing the work of an evangelist, you know, there was a core amount of stuff I knew, and then there was things I was kind of learning, kind of batting around, and sometimes I'd teach those things. That was not good, because those were things that I was still in flux. I was still absorbing and assimilating and organizing and thinking about and considering various passages, and so I'd sometimes find myself, I remember one time, this is probably one of the worst things I did. I found this awesome book. It was on Matthew 24. It was good on that. And Revelation 20. I didn't know a whole lot about Revelation, but boy, that book on Revelation 20 was just tremendous. It made so much sense. And so I just went to the pulpit and preached right what that guy had said. Later, years later, when I studied Revelation, it's like, oh my, that wasn't at all what that passage was talking about. Now, the brethren liked it, actually, which is bad, probably. You know, fortunately, it wasn't something subversive I taught, but it was totally wrong, totally out of the context of Revelation 20. Don't teach something you're just learning. You're just kind of sorting out, because that's probably going to be modified some as you keep growing. Hopefully, as we grow, our core gradually grows, and there's more and more stuff we do understand, but there's still always stuff on the fringes we're just kind of trying to figure out. I would say also, there are some things that you have reason to have great conviction about. It's clear in the scriptures. You feel confident that you studied that and you know what it's saying. And you say that more forcefully, more boldly, more strongly. There are some things you're not sure about. Or you think it may be this way. Here's the reason I think that, but I'm not sure. I think we whisper those things. We're more tentative. Because, I mean, we don't want to commit the Lord to something he hasn't said. So we don't want to be more categorical about something than what we're confident the Bible is. So that's kind of the bad thing about teaching a Bible class like this. You get all kinds of questions, and sometimes you don't know for sure what the answer is, and I think you need to say that. Maybe a little easier when you're preaching, you just don't talk about the things you don't know. Juliana. Yes, in 1 Corinthians 7. So when he was giving an opinion that wasn't an order, wasn't a command from God, he made that clear. Not everything is a matter of being commanded by God. Yeah, good point. Matt.
You say these three roles that we've been talking about, the descriptions that we see, I mean, these men, they need to have good reputation, not just in the church. They need to be out in the community as well. I mean, the elders, they have to have a good reputation, those outside the church. The deacons have to be dignified. They have to be seen as good managers. I mean, the evangelists, no one's going to listen to them if they're not men of character.
Well, if you're not a man of character, you're not going to do very well in anything. Now, you know, I think a person can have a bad past and be converted, and he may have to live that down, but that's okay. You know, he can still serve the Lord. But if somebody doesn't have good character now, they're really not going to do any work for the Lord in a responsible way. Sure. Sure. And realize that our conduct reflects on the Lord. Yeah, definitely. Other thoughts? Okay. I suggested what role do the apostles and prophets play in the church today? Now look at Ephesians for a minute. Apostles and prophets, again, do not seem to be roles that were associated specifically with a local church. They were more roles in the church universal, I would suggest. But he says in verse 20 of Ephesians 2, we're built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Christ Jesus himself being the cornerstone. You also have in Revelation 21:14 the names of the 12 apostles on the foundation stones of that city, New Jerusalem. And the idea is the work of the apostles and prophets was foundational. They revealed the message that is the foundation document for us as servants of the Lord. And so you see in chapter 3, Paul talks about by revelation in verse 3, there was made known to me the mystery, as I wrote before in brief. By referring to this, when you read, you can understand my insight in the mystery of Christ, which in other generations was not made known to the sons of men, as it has now been revealed to his holy apostles and prophets in the Spirit. So the revelation was given to Paul and other apostles and prophets that they would write or speak to others so that they would know the will of God. The apostles and prophets were the revealers of what God's message was. What role do they have in the church today? Well, the same role they've always had. They are the ones that define for us the truth because they've revealed the truth from God. We don't have living apostles and prophets today. We have the same ones we've always had. Somebody might say, do you have apostles in your church? My answer would be yes. And they say, who are they? I'd say, well, Peter, Andrew, James, and John. You know, the same ones we've always had. It's like saying, does America have founding fathers? Well, of course. Well, we don't have new founding fathers every generation. We have the same ones we've always had. And so the apostles and prophets revealed the message that we follow. And I think that was primarily their role. I'm not saying exclusively. They were representatives of Christ in some other ways. But I think for us, that's the most important thing for us to think about is their foundation work for us. Terry.
And that's why we will be held accountable for what we have done in building on this foundation, whether it's wood, hay, or stubble, that we're referenced to, and that's we're building on top of the things we're taking, what we have and why we build on what's been given to us. To me, it's what he's linking all of us.
Okay. Other thoughts? Justin. Right.
But in 2 Thessalonians, I think it's 3, where Paul talks about we were among you, and we hear there are some that are not working among you. And he kept talking about how we didn't take anyone's bread, and we were disciplined. Like, I think that's one thing that, to me, kind of comes out, because having thought about being an evangelist earlier in my life, that was really the big problem for myself at the time of being disciplined, with a sense not having this exact schedule that I had to keep and all these things. I feel like that's something that is an attribute that has to be found in a man who wants to, you know, be an evangelist.
And in many ways, in anyone who wants to serve the Lord, we've got to be diligent, we've got to be disciplined, but especially if we are supported in the work of an evangelist, mm-hmm. we don't have a job. Mm-hmm. We ought to have a job, mm-hmm. you know, and need to be disciplined about it. And sometimes, you know, there's nobody we directly work for other than the Lord, and he's not going to come down and tap us on the shoulder. So we've got to be conscientious before God. I think remembering always that we do our work for the Lord, and he's always watching us. He knows what we're doing. So it ought to keep us serious about what we're doing. Good thought. Other things. So I suggested at the end here that there's a grave danger of churches abandoning the truth. What did some Christians in the early centuries do to try to lessen this risk? So you kind of had the idea in the first century, second century, third century, and so forth, that what can you do to make sure all the brethren stay faithful? And it's kind of like if you were a director of Walmart, you wouldn't want a bad Walmart store. So what do you do to make sure all the Walmart franchises or whatever they are, stores, stay in line and be what you want to be? People have that same attitude toward the church. You know, how can we keep all the churches in line? How can we make sure they all keep up the quality standards we all have and things like that? They all teach the truth. And what people did in those first few centuries was to invent some things that from their mind was a way of keeping all the churches in line and avoiding false doctrine and things like that, but were actually things God did not authorize and God didn't want them to do or to have. And so I'd like for you to be thinking about that for Sunday morning. We'll work on that a little bit, because I think those are the same tendencies we sometimes have. That we're thinking, well, I want to make sure all the churches stay in line. What can we do to make sure that happens? Well, only things that are authorized in the Bible. And so we need to think about that. So we'll finish that question on Sunday morning. And then my lesson 8 goes all over the place. It's just several things I wanted to throw together. Eventually, we'll talk about the idea of the authority God has. But I started with some things about the Bible itself. Some of them are kind of just things that need to be talked about sometime, and I kind of done that in the lesson, so I thought we'd do that. But it'll take us probably a couple weeks, probably 3 or 4 classes to get through lesson 8. So you can start on that. We'll work through some of that on Sunday morning. Thank you for your attention and your questions, comments.